It can be done as long as there's a fiscal sponsor until incorporation takes place.
Right.
One of the things that I would note for the record is that any nonprofit corporation, any nonprofit organization in the state of California has to be registered with the Office of the Secretary of State in Sacramento. A form has to be filed. I'm not sure if it's a 2310 form or not, to be approved by the Office of the Secretary of State of California. Was the Mae Brussel Research Center ever incorporated?
No, this is still an independent identity.
And it should be noted, too, that the center was actually begun in September of 1988, and it went belly up in December of 89 or January of 90. That's a period of some 16 months. But you're saying that it was never incorporated?
No.
And it is your contention, your recollection, that John Judge was not keeping accurate financial records?
Right, that's my opinion.
Now, are there other people who share that opinion?
Yes, and at the end, he hired an accountant to quickly put the books together and piece them together from all the records that had been kept scantily. And to fictitiously recreate an accounting as if the books had been kept all along, where it was clear to everyone that they had not been and that this woman was hired to save face at the last minute.
So what you're saying, basically, is that you're of the opinion that John cooked the books.
Yeah. And I know that approximately $50,000 that was raised was recorded. There may have been more money raised by the center that we'll never know about.
Now, this brings us, what, to about November or December of 1989,
Cayenne? Yes.
What transpired next?
Well, John was hanging out with this gal named Wendy from Washington, D.C., and she came in as an overnight researcher who had supposedly been doing this work a long time and cared and wanted to help the center get off the ground, but none of us had ever heard of her, and May had certainly never heard of her. And John was apparently in love with her and would stay up all night talking on the phone. The volunteers would hear him in the other room talking baby talk on the phone with Wendy. And John wanted to have her come and be part of the board. And this was around the same time that I was wanting to expand the board to include May's friends, and John was refusing or dissuading me from doing that, from including other people that May had trusted and liked and explicitly expressed that she wanted on the board. And John was trying to make that not happen. So at that point, I brought in an attorney who was friends of our family to get the incorporation process happening and to extend the board.
This some 15 or 16 months after the center had actually begun and monies were beginning to be solicited.
Yes. And around that time, my husband, Avishai, got a scary, threatening phone call. It was anti-Semitic and called him a dirty Jew and that he was going to be killed. And I don't know that this has anything to do with it, but it was at a time when this woman, Wendy, was around who I didn't feel secure with, and I was opposing her position coming into the center in a central way. And obviously I got this phone call, and the next morning the mirror on my car had been vandalized. I mean, this may have been a coincidence, but it was suspicious and it was frightening.
I would note, as I will go into at greater length later, John Judge had a long-standing, though as yet indeterminate, relationship with elements of a far right-wing tax protest organization, some of whose members at any rate appear to be Aryan Nations or of Aryan Nations orientation. They are, some of them, and again, I am not accusing John of this, but he did have a relationship of indeterminate nature over a period of years with elements of this group, at least one person or one or two people, and that they were into, at least some of them, into identity Christianity, which is the anti-Semitic theology of the Aryan Nations. And that was something that I had deep misgivings about. Those misgivings deepened enormously when Cayenne's husband received the anti-Semitic death threat and her car was vandalized. Cayenne, have you received any threats since that time?
In the fall of 1990, I got another scary phone call. It was nothing specific, but it was very scary. It had some creepy music, and it said, "I deeply weep for you. I deeply sympathize," with a very lurchy, deep, scary voice, and played some creepy music, and that was it. That was a second call in the spring, the following spring.
Okay, so now the other threatening call or creepy phone call was in the fall or the spring of 90?
The spring of 90.
Spring of 90, okay.
Yeah.
Now, what was it specifically that bothered you and others about this woman, Wendy? And I would interject at this point that I never met the woman and am unfamiliar except by third-hand accounts of what this was all about, so I'm not in a position to evaluate this past the point myself.
Well, the woman came in from Washington, D.C. as an overnight researcher and was supposedly in love with John Judge. And their love affair consisted of long telephone talks and of tape cassettes that she would send him. And I heard one of these cassettes that the volunteers had gotten hold of, and it sounded like my understanding of what I've heard of mind control.
Mm-hmm.
With codes and hypnotic trances and referring back to things that she had said before and speaking in this sort of double talk language.
Mm-hmm.
Using code words. And it was, that alone was very scary, along with John's behavior, which I'll later get into, that seemed, indicative of somebody on mind control, or my understanding of that process. And that John wanted her to come in and be part of the board, and somebody who was, she was new in his life, and yet he was so suspicious of people that May had known for 15 years, yet he was willing to let this woman in overnight, nearly. There was also talk that she had been at some gathering or party in Washington with William Bennett, the drug czar, and hobnobbed in some of these inner circles in Washington, D.C.
Now, I myself was sent a copy of one of these cassettes, and it did sound very strange. In fact, the aforementioned Will Robinson of KAZU obtained one of these cassettes, and that cassette is now, by the way, on file with counsel. It did sound strange to me. I never met the woman, Wendy, but she was talking in a very strange, sort of hypnotic-sounding way. I remember one conversation where she said, "We're going out beyond the stars, beyond the sun, past Venus, past Pluto." And I don't know whether it was a mind control tape or whether this was John and Wendy's concept of aesthetics, but it certainly sounded very, very strange.
Yes. And when the topic was brought up of Wendy being part of the board, and I expressed my misgivings around this,
mm-hmm.
She sat with a cold face the entire time, and at the end squeezed out a few tears and proceeded to attempt to make me feel guilty, I imagine, saying, "I don't know why you suspect me, and I just want to help out, and I'm just a good person who wants to do what I can." And I said to her, "Look, if you know anything about this work, surely you can respect my suspicions of you without taking them personally. If you have any sense of what this work is about and how valuable this collection is and how justified I would be in my feelings." And yet, you know, she persisted in this, as I saw them, crocodile tears.
Well, that obviously I'm not in a position to evaluate. I was not at the meeting. I would note at this point that as of December of 1989, John had entered into open defiance of the desires of the Brussel family in the person, obviously, of Cayenne Brussel, who was handling the Brussel estate on behalf of the family. Cayenne, you mentioned that you were frightened, obviously, when Abishai got the death threat. Were you yourself frightened at this point of the situation with Wendy?
Yes, I was frightened for not only our safety, but for the collection and for John, wondering who he was and how much he was working with her, how much he was under her control.
Mm-hmm.
And but the whole situation felt very unsafe for me, and I didn't feel good about the collection, especially with John referring to it as his own. It made me feel very uncomfortable. And at that time, my brother wrote a letter on behalf of our family to John, asking him for his resignation, you know, to step out. And at the same time, John wrote a resignation letter that crossed in the mail. I believe they crossed in the mail at that time.
Now, your brother is an attorney, correct?
Right.
Right. Okay, so your attorney brother wrote a letter informing John, basically, that he was no longer welcome, and his letter of resignation crossed in the mails.
Yes.
Now, what happened after that, Kyan?
Well, John hired an accountant before the last meeting, as I said, to fictitiously present the books, and approximately $50,000 was said to be raised, but we don't know how much more was actually raised beyond that. I know that there were big checks written that John wrote to himself saying that they were reimbursement for money that he had put in. There were several checks around $5,000 that he had written to himself reimbursing for who knows what. These things were never itemized. And when Tom and Will went to close out the bank account, Tom's name, which had been a co-signer on the account, had been removed and he was denied to look at the records or the transactions that had happened. And he was furious and baffled and said to the bank, "How can you do this? I'm a co-signer and I've written checks on this account." And somehow they protected John, who had changed the books secretly without informing Tom, and it had Tom's name removed so that he couldn't look at the financial records. And later that day, they ran into each other at a Xerox shop, and John completely ignored Tom in a small Xerox shop in Santa Cruz. Tom was aghast because John was not only an old friend and had tried to avoid direct conflict with John, had gone out of his way to step out and not confront him, was now being totally ignored by John in the confines of 3 feet. John looked right past him like a zombie, and this was the other point that made me suspicious about mind control. Is he was in a total state of denial, or he was under some kind of hypnosis, because, and Tom could express this better than I could because it was his own experience, but I remember him totally dumbfounded by that.
What transpired after that, Kyan?
Well, I need to also say that bank account remained active for months after the center was officially closed, and after the time that John had agreed upon to close out the account. I had heard when we were on the day that we were cleaning the house and closing out that there was approximately $2,000 plus in the bank account left. And that was after John had paid himself back and reimbursed this and that. Several months later, I got the statement from the bank with the balance that had been left, which was $569.
Out of some $50,000 allegedly collected.
Right, after also being told that there was going to be over $2,000, which was surprisingly low in itself, to get the check back for $500. And $69. Also, the account had been active, clearly, because, you know, nearly $1,500 had been removed or used or spent in some other way beyond the time that John had promised to have the account closed. There was a series of promises and agreements that John failed to follow through on.
What were some of those, Kyan?
Well, this is one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And just meetings and times, just a series of things. It's hard to, I mean, all of the things I've been speaking about.
All right. So this, at this point, you're saying that the Mae Russell Research Center account remained active for a considerable period of time after John agreed to close it.
Yes. And one of those other agreements that John made that he failed to follow through on was giving me a list of labels with the donors.
Mm-hmm.
He promised to have a mailing list so that I could send out a mailing to the nearly 5,000 members of the center and let them know, in my own words, what had happened. Well, he didn't provide me the list of labels, as he promised, and he gave me a computer disk with no instructions as to how to access. He made it sound rather simple to use and as if I'd have no problems, which later I found it more complex for myself. But he didn't follow through on the labels and didn't make it easy for me to do a mailing of any sort to the donors.
Okay.
And that was another one of the agreements that John failed to follow through on. Another one comes to mind now, which is on the closing of the center, I came in with Karen and several of the volunteers to clean the house to get the cleaning deposit back. Cleaning deposit was, I think, $1,480. It was over $1,400.
Mm-hmm.
And John clearly expressed that if we cleaned the house, of course we could have the cleaning deposit. Well, we came in as a team and worked all day. The house was filthy. It hadn't been cleaned in the whole time that it had existed. There was dust and dirt and filth everywhere. And we scrubbed the house from top to bottom. And John left for the day. He said, oh, hello, and he went out, and he didn't lift a finger. And when I spoke to the landlord later, he told me that John had told him that the cleaning deposit was to be sent back to John, contrary to what John had told me. And this is the kind of things that shrouded John Judge's, my experience with John Judge, just surrounded every dealing, especially as it went on, filled with inconsistencies and mistrust and failing to follow through and double stories to different people. And the landlord had been told by John that John would forward the cleaning deposit to me, which he never did. And I've written him letters asking about it, which he either didn't answer or didn't pick up. I sent a certified letter, which months later was returned to me unclaimed.
Now, John never signed for the certified letter?
No.
Do you know if he had moved, or was he still living at the same address?
I checked that out with several people who would know, and that was the last address they had for him.
Okay.
Yeah. And then furthermore, the mail had been being forwarded to me from the research center. And just this last spring, when I was failing to get any more mail, I called the post office. And they said that the forward had expired. And rather than letting me know that the expiration date was coming up, they just flipped the mail back to go back to John Judge at that point.
Okay.
And I told them they couldn't do that, you know, the mailbox was taken out under the Mae Brussel Research Center, to whom I was now responsible, and that our board had decided that this is where the mail would come, et cetera, et cetera. And the postmaster rigorously defended John and said that because he had been the one that had rented the box, that's where the mail was going now that it had expired. And I said, well, what if I send in the check to pay for the reissuing of it? And he said, no, it's too late. And I mean, there wasn't much mail coming at that point, but it was disturbing to find that the mail was again going back to John, and that his connection to the center and to the donor list and to the people that want to support my mother's work was being intercepted by him.
In other words, John had somehow managed to, in contradiction of your agreement or contravention of your agreement, he had somehow managed to arrange for the mail to be forwarded to him rather than you.
I can't say for sure that he had arranged that, but it seemed to be that the postmaster was in cahoots with him. I can't say definitely, but it looked that way.
Okay.
Given the other circumstances, I wouldn't be surprised.
All righty. Well, obviously that is an open question, but it is certainly a very interesting and possibly sinister one. Is there anything else that you wanted to relate about what happened with the center, Cayenne? Any other interesting or alarming details?
Well, there's this prevailing winds that came out in Santa Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you advised me not to give them permission to sell May's research.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked the fellow there, Patrick Forney, to what extent he was involved with John Judge, because this organization opened up soon after the center had closed, Santa Barbara. And he made it sound like they didn't have much of a connection at all, and that he just wanted to sell all the researchers, and you know, published works or printed materials to get out as much information as he could. And I felt a little cautious and suspicious about him, but he, he urged me to let him sell my mother's work, that he just wanted to get out her valuable information, et cetera. And it seems that he is more connected with John than he would have me believe.
Well, I would add that this organization is once again called Prevailing Winds Research from Santa Barbara, California, about which I have no hard information. In the spring of 1990, Cayenne called me asking me if I had ever heard of that organization or this fellow Patrick Forme. And the answer was no on both accounts. When you're in this line of work, sometimes you learn to go on instinct. So I basically sniffed the air. I advised Cayenne against giving permission for them to reprint May's material because it just felt, and this was nothing more than instinct, that this might very well represent John Judge attempting to get back in the door somehow. I would add that in the fall of 1990, John Judge appeared on radio station KFI in Los Angeles as a guest. I was able to get that broadcast very faintly. And at the end, John referred people to Prevailing Winds Research for access to his material. I would also say that I have been told, and this is hearsay, so as such, should be taken perhaps with a grain of salt, that Patrick Forme recently arranged for a major speaking engagement for John Judge in Toronto. I know he had such an engagement, and I will prove that later in the broadcast. I have been told, and there may be nothing to it, but I have been told that the aforementioned Patrick Forme did help arrange that speaking engagement, but that is hearsay evidence and should be taken as such.
Yeah, the only other thing I want to say is that at the beginning of this whole procedure, I didn't want to believe that about John. And it was easier...
Didn't want to believe which kind?
Didn't want to believe that there was any misgivings around him or that he was suspicious or that there was any deeper reason for alarm beyond him being a difficult personality to get along with or, you know, a quirky individual. I would rather have attributed the trouble and the conflict to elements of his personality. And at the time that a lot of the conflict started to happen, it was hard for me to see that. It was hard for me to recognize that John was not worthy of my trust and that there's integrity issues to be questioned here surrounding John Judge. And that... And that I just really appreciate the support that I felt I've had from you.
Okay. Two quick questions, kind of three very quick questions, because we're going to have to move along. We're almost out of time and tape. It says here in Vankin's book, the center collapsed to be resurrected by Davis and some associates as the Mae Russell Library in Seaside, California. Is the library resurrected in Seaside?
No, that's not true at all. Oh. I know that Will took out a P.O. box in Seaside. That's not even where the account is based, which is based in Berkeley through a P.O. box there.
Okay.
That is just where Will gets his mail anonymously, and that is not where the center is not set up, or the library is not set up in any sense at this point. We hope to work with it later, but it's in no state at this point to be resurrected.
Okay, Cayenne. I wanted to get your opinion on one more piece of information here. Again, reading from Jonathan Vankin's book, his relating of Tom Davis's opinion. But says Davis, one of the problems, quote, one of the problems was Dave Emery. Davis says he personally implored Emery, to whom the Mae Russell Research Center will always be so called, not to attack the center on his show. In the fall of 1989, Emery burst. Restraining himself for a year, he could no longer hold it in and went on the air accusing Judge of financial improprieties and other sordid acts. In private, Emery is even more vitriolic. What I am being the person most in the vantage point to assess what happened with the center, what is your opinion of Tom Davis's assessment, basically laying much of the blame on the center's demise on yours truly?
Well, I think it's grotesque because Tom, as well as anyone close to the center, would know how much John was at the heart of all of the problems that went on there. And he himself was involved with disappointments and shocking revelations about John Judge. So to the extent that this is an accurate quote of Tom Davis, I'm appalled.
Cayenne, the last question I want to ask you is, what was your impression of my role and activities vis-a-vis you and the center?
Well, I know that you had a lot of concern and fear around the center and frustration as well, that people were not seeing what you were saying about John early on. And I felt a lot of support from you throughout that process. I know that when I felt afraid and I felt that you were really there and doing what you could to protect myself as well as the material.
All righty. Well, that I was certainly doing my best in that regard. And again, I will be giving my own account of not only the conflicts between John Judge, but also other pieces of information which people might not be aware of, a speaking engagement which had been tentatively arranged between John and I in Los Angeles. John managed to cut me out of that, basically maneuvering me out of $200 and some other things not directly relevant to what happened with the people at the center proper. Well, Cayenne, it's been unpleasant for you, I'm sure, and I know it's been unpleasant for me to have to go back and relive this very unpleasant and, this, for me at least, very searing experience. But I want to thank you for your participation and for your bravery and integrity in agreeing to help set the record straight about what actually happened with the center. I think I can say with confidence that May would not have wanted the fictional account of what happened with the May Brussels Center as presented in Vankin's book to pass into the historical record. I also would note in passing, as I will have already discussed on the air by the time this airs, that the book itself was published by Paragon House, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Reverend Moon's Unification Church. While Vankin's own connection with it might be perfectly innocent, he may not, he very well not have known, and I fully acknowledge that for the record. The fact of the matter is that this book is going to make monies for Reverend Moon. And beyond that, Vankin has been very visible as of late doing the talk show circuit and specifically dropping May's name in an attempt, basically, in my opinion, to sell books. And I think I can state with absolute confidence that if May were alive, if she read the account that appears in Vankin's book, and if she knew that he was dropping her name to sell books for the Reverend Moon, she would spit in his face.
She'd be doing much of what you're doing right now.
Well, I'm doing what I can, and I will continue to do that. So, Cayenne, once again, I want to thank you for agreeing to appear.
Sure, thank you, Dave.
And I will be doing everything I can to continue to support you, and when necessary, if necessary, and I hope not, protect you. And I'm looking forward to seeing you again.
Me too. Take care.
Okie doke.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.